1230 AM, W255 DN Wausau. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. The Trump administration brings Kilmar Abrego-Garcia back to the U.S. to face human smuggling charges that stem from a traffic stop in 2022. CBS legal analyst Jessica Levinson.
If he is in fact convicted, then he would serve time in a federal prison. At that point, you could begin the process of removing him to El Salvador.
Former police chief and convicted killer Grant Hardin is captured after escaping from a northern Arkansas prison on May 25th. CBS's Ian Lee.
A special team from the Border Patrol that specializes in searches like this. They came in to help out. They had dogs that were able to pick up the scent of Hardin.
The Labor Department says employers added a solid 139,000 jobs in May. Bank rate Stephen Juneau on sectors leading the way.
It's really still education and health. Really within that, I would say it's health more than education, and it's leisure and hospitality. Those two sectors alone add out 135,000 jobs.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
A homestand for the Brewers. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Milwaukee Brewers begin a 12-game homestand tonight, their longest of the season, against the Padres. That's followed by the Braves next week, and then the second-place Cardinals, the crew coming off a day's rest after beating the Reds 9-1 on Wednesday. NFL. Aaron Rodgers will sign a one-year deal to play for the Pittsburgh Steelers. Rodgers has kept in touch with their head coach.
Listen, I've talked to Mike Tomlin. Great dude. It was nice to go into the city. I never really spent any time in Pittsburgh other than the few times we've played there. But yeah, I've enjoyed talking to Mike.
NBA Finals, Oshkosh North High School grad Tyrese Halliburton has done it again. A last-second shot to lead the Pacers to a win in the playoffs, 111-110 over the Thunder in Game 1 of the Finals.
Man, we just keep believing and we stay together. And it ain't over till it's over. It ain't over till it hits zero. And we just keep pushing. So, like I said, really proud of this group.
That's the Pacers' Tyrese Halliburton with Sports on Mike Clemens.
Summer. It's time for Civic Media's Scotty Summer Text to Win contest right here on this local Civic Media radio station. We want to hook you up with $100 cash, Milwaukee Brewers club level tickets, and the chance to win a summer getaway to the Wisconsin Dells area or an escape to Door County. Download the free Civic Media app in the Google Play or App Store. Then listen in for the keywords during the 7 and 11 a.m. hour and 2 and 4 p.m. hour. Text in the keyword and get set to win. It's Civic Media's Scotty Summer. This is Bull Falls Radio, WXCO.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Social Media Day. Trump was on social media the other day on Truth Social. And with his latest Trump truth, he said the United States has the best May in 30 years. Make America great again. Only problem is the Federal Reserve's beige book said no. The economy slowed to a crawl in May. Private sector job growth, according to the most recent report, 37,000, well under expectation. The brakes are slamming. And I got to wonder, is it just that he lives in his own little deluded world? Or is this how you cover for the bad things that that are happening? Is this the cover for how bad things are for working people while we're in the midst of Real Narcissists of Washington, D.C., the bromance edition? Because we are witnessing now two egomaniacal narcissists fighting over a basement rug. Well, if you haven't been paying attention, evidently Elon and Donnie have they're parting ways. And they're doing it in, well, what I predicted a while ago is the most them way possible, by snarking at each other on social media. Trump declaring that he won the election all by himself without any help from Elon. And of course, Elon saying, without me, Trump would have lost the election and Democrats had controlled the House and the Senate. Yeah. But you know, hey, this is what I predicted from the beginning, that the bromance would break up, because you can't have two narcissists in a relationship. You can't have two people who are low information voters who want their way. You can't have that. Now, again, the kids, the Republicans, I'll go with them as the children in this. They don't know what to do because mom and dad are fighting and they don't want to get into a war with either. And this is going to be the fun for me. And this is what I said from the beginning. The fun is going to be watching how the Republican Party tip-taps around this, because they're afraid of Donald Trump and his red hats. But they're also, and I think they're more afraid of Elon and his money and what he can do to put to run people against them. So they're really walking on eggshells. Oh, and the big, beautiful bill, that big nightmare, that's in trouble. So much so that Senate Republicans are looking at cutting Medicare because, hey, let's tick off seniors instead of Elon or Donald. Yeah, going to be interesting. Now, Elon, you know, put out the big one. He dropped the nuke. He did. He dropped the nuke on X or Twitter or whatever we're calling it, by tweeting out, time to drop the real big bomb. At real Donald Trump is in the Epstein files. That is the real reason they have not been made public. Have a nice day, DJT! Exclamation point. Now, what's interesting, and I got to wonder, does he have the Epstein files? Is this what, again, because remember, Elon's got everything. He had big balls in there grabbing every bit of data. You had all of his little, his ferrets in there grabbing everything. Does Musk already have it? And again, this is one of those moments where both parties, I know the Summers Democrats are saying maybe we could lure Elon back our way to take on Trump. Don't even think about it. But this is a moment where potentially, and this is where my hope from the beginning was, that people realize that having one narcissist, one guy like Musk, having the kind of power, the outweighed power, the resource, is dangerous for democracy. And maybe they're going to come around to what I've been saying for 20 years now. It's time to tax these people out of existence, use those resources to redistribute back to the working class of this country and restore prosperity back to work. And Donald Trump, you know, he truthed out something along that way. He said the easiest way to save money in our budget, billions and billions of dollars, is to terminate Elon's governmental subsidy and contracts. And he says, I was always surprised that Biden didn't do it. Yeah, okay. Now, Steve Bannon, not to be undone, not to be outdone, he has stepped in and said, it's time for Donald Trump to deport Elon Musk. Oh, boy, the fun. Oh, and guess what? Elon is floating the idea of a third party. Okay, he's throwing it out. He's got the poll out there asking, is it time to create a new political party in America that actually represents the 80% in the middle? Again, not quite sure where he went to school, but you don't have 80% in the middle. That's generally not how that works. And it's interesting timing. Comes the day after neoliberals' welcome fest. Interesting timing. But for me, the coming days, weeks, as this escalates, and it's going to escalate, because here are two guys who, well, they don't sleep much, and they got to wonder what they're taking to do that. And they just seem to love the attention of social media. They need the dopamine hit of how many likes and how many impressions and how many stories are about it. So we're going to see this volleying back and forth, so much so that, you know, one of the websites that does political betting, because you can bet on anything in this world. But the political betting questions are, you know, who will unfollow who first on social media? You know, will Donald Trump have Elon arrested or deported? This, you know, well, look, if the country's going down in flames because of the bad policies here, It might as well be entertaining. This, my friends, bread and circus on steroids. And for me, Democrats, one, step out of the way. Don't save this dysfunctional fight. Like I said, these are two narcissists fighting over the basement rug. This is an unholy matrimony that was never going to work out, that everyone who attended the wedding knew was not going to work out. And like me, we're taking bets of when that was going to happen, when the breakup would happen, and, well, who would get the dishes, and if any of them would be left unbroken. It appears not. Now, for Democrats, what they should be doing out of this is, one, as I said, top marginal tax rate. We don't need billionaires. Time to tax them out of existence. But to really start talking about policies of good governance, all of the things that Trump has done, all the things that Musk did, these are poster issues that you then take back to the American people and go, look at how bad they did. Look at this train wreck. Look at the nightmare that they've caused. And look, we're going to have to clean this mess up. We're all going to have to foot the bill for the chaos that they've caused. All of us, through diminished services, through higher taxes, to have to cover the costs of doing all this stuff and cleaning up the mess. There's a lot here for Democrats to use as good fodder to bring people around. Which is why I think the center folk, the neo-lib crowd, see, this is their opportunity to maybe grab an Elon and bring him into the moneyed fold, because it really is just about the money. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Henry Burke's going to be here from the Revolving Door Project to talk about, the Welcome Fest, the neo-lib DLC Fest, and what comes out of that? Quick break. Right back with Henry.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So for the many who had the good fortune or sense to avoid the ballroom full of consultants, billionaires, and centrist podcasters, wannabe book writers, all of those who gathered in D.C. on Wednesday, only to conclude, as I get this, and boldly conclude that centrism proudly stands for nothing. But it means saying that nothing very loudly and with questionable data. They championed common sense, heard that a lot, while avoiding talking about anything that they actually believed in. They chased quote-unquote normal with Harvard slideshows and asked how much nothing can they sell and still sound electable. Basically, this was a neoliberal love fest that highlighted everything working people despise about the Democratic Party. I did not pay an awful lot of attention to it, didn't really think it was all that important, but I got to be honest, they did say some of the quiet parts out loud on the Democratic side, especially about their disdain for labor. And here to share some thoughts on the neo-lib love fest, I've asked Henry Burke to come talk with us. Henry is a senior researcher there at the Revolving Door Project. You can check out their website, therevolvingdoorproject.org. Henry, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on.
So I got to be honest, I knew about the Big Love Fest. I knew that the DLC neoliberal types were going to have their little powwow with billionaire money and didn't really care until some of your coverage. I got to be honest. I followed you on social media, saw some of the attacks on labor, saw some of the rhetoric coming out, and my mind went to, yeah, this is why people hate Democrats.
Yeah, so it's not, you know, universal, their attacks on labor. It was definitely some. But it was a conference where centrist groups could kind of gather and commiserate about being oppressed by the evil left wing of the party. They've branded, you know, any nonprofit group, any good governance group, any watchdog group, as this term they now use called the groups. And, you know, they're trying to start their own version of the groups to stand boldly against civil liberties organizations, government watchdogs, environmentalists, and anybody else who stands in the way of their agenda.
Now, this is the corporatist wing of the Democratic Party. And when I say when working people don't despise Democrats, it's this segment, this fragment, this group who gets, you know, that kind of ire, and why we can't seem to get the things that working people need to get done actually done, like, you know, universal health care or Medicare for all, however you want to frame that, good funding for education, you know, bold labor reform, things that actually need to get done. These are the folks that stand in the way, the Joe Manchins of the world, the Kyrsten Sinemas.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Joe Manchin, the co-founder of the group hosting it, Welcome Pack, Liam Kerr, he's the co-founder, was actually wearing a Joe Manchin football jersey at the event the whole time. I think he had to have that custom made. I don't think those are a common issue from the University of West Virginia, but I thought that was very telling about where they stood politically.
And this is where, you know, I get tagged with this a lot, because some people go, well, you're a centrist. I go, no, I'm a working class liberal. I think that we need to do a lot more on the economic front, especially for working people. But I'm not a corporatist. You know, at the end of this, you know, I still see them as a big part of the problem. And a lot of the reason we don't get the things that working people need is because there is a corporate arm of the Democratic Party that seems, and because of Citizens United, all the money that needs to be spent, that they have a large influence over the direction of the party, in my view.
Yeah, that's for sure. I actually started paying attention to the Welcome Fest, this event, with my colleague Vishal Shankar, and we started paying attention because we were just curious about who are the funders of this, you know, this group that's getting a senator, multiple members of Congress, and very influential pundits to attend and speak. And when we looked under the hood, we found about half of the Walton family, you know, the wealthiest family in America. We saw Reid Hoffman is there. He's the founder of LinkedIn, who was a Harris donor, but who requested that she fire Lina Khan, the chair of the FTC. There were some Wall Street folks as well, the son of Rupert Murdoch, you know, a lot of figures who I think a lot of people might be interested to know, you know, are funding it. And, you know, their funders were not advertised. Obviously, this is something they prefer to keep under wraps. And so we just thought it was worthwhile to publish that. And then after writing that up, I was like, hey, let's see what's going on at this event. Let's follow what they're saying and to see what these billionaires think they're getting out of spending all this money. And you know what? I would say they're getting their money's worth.
Yeah, I mean, look, the news over the last couple of days, has, you know, since Wednesday's powwow, has been all about abundance and all about, you know, their well, nothing. I mean, I don't know what the policy agenda is other than, you know, going after the same kind of deregulatory things that Trump and the Republicans are, only in different ways, only ways that are more focused at working people, in my view. What did you come away with?
Yeah, I would say that this definitely wasn't an organized political platform so much as it was very unwelcoming to the left. This event was marketed as kind of a way to extend the Democratic tent to, you know, people who might be traditionally more centrist or right wing. And they might have been doing that, but they were certainly not expanding the tent in the other direction. It was not very welcoming to the left.
Right.
But I did see a lot of disagreement. I will say that. They had congressional candidates, both successful and unsuccessful, speak there. And I think a lot of them were a lot more normal than some of the pundits who were speaking. So Matthew Yglesias was there, centrist blogger who's actually very influential in D.C. And he had some of the, I would say, the worst takes of the day. Josh Barrow is the pundit who made the comments about labor. And I would say that they were definitely out of step, possibly, with the elected officials who maybe were just being less incendiary in public, but definitely didn't seem to agree with them. And so this seems like a disparate movement of people who are just generally angry at the vaguely left or left of center part of the Democratic Party.
And who is it? I mean, when you talk about the left, because I get this a lot, and they go, you know, people, well, you're on the left. I go, yeah, I'm a labor guy. I think that, you know, demanding better wages, hours, conditions, health care, retirement security, you know, good schools for my kids, all that stuff. If that puts me on the left, then I'm happy there. And fighting for equal rights for people, because I do believe in life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. If that puts me there, then fine, I'm happy there. But I didn't see anything really coming out of this centrist group that would make me go, yeah, I identify with them. So, you know, in to what you've said, you know, how is this going to play in the general public? How does this move the needle within the party, or is this just the moneyed interests, you know, kind of flexing a little bit of muscle to keep their influence in place?
Definitely. So this is the second annual Welcome Pack. The first one was explicitly centrist. This one was as well. But as you've said, this one definitely had an abundance influence to that centrism. And I would say that abundance is not a grassroots movement. They're not reaching, you know, everyday Democratic voters, be they union members, African-American voters throughout the country. They're not reaching the grassroots. This is really an elite influence campaign. They are funding think tanks. They're funding, you know, lobbying operations, philanthropies, and they are going to municipal leaders, state-level elected officials, and congressional leaders with a proposal to unleash what they call abundance. And depending on who you ask, that abundance is somewhat more left-wing or somewhat more right-wing inclined. But at the end of the day, I would say that the main thrust of abundance is about loosening government regulations that they claim are the main barrier to, you know, material prosperity in the United States.
Yeah, you've already lost me on this, because, you know, that sounds an awful lot of what Donald Trump and Elon Musk and their ilk are trying to do right now. So explain to me how a leftward version of what Trump is doing is going to help me.
Yeah, and I will say straight up, I think that there are members of the Trump administration who would, whether they consider themselves abundance fans or not, abundance fans have celebrated their appointment. So that's the Interior Secretary, you know, even Elon Musk has promoted, there was an Ezra Klein clip with John Stewart, and Elon Musk was promoting it. Obviously, he seems to be pushed out of the Trump administration now, but definitely very right wing. And, you know, the abundance agenda kind of goes from ending exclusionary zoning, which definitely something seems fine in my book, to eliminating environmental reviews for oil and gas projects. And so there's this expansive reach of what it is. But at the end of the day, it's about eliminating government regulation to ensure that private investors can unleash, you know, their investments, build as much as they can. And the thought is that private investment will help stimulate the economy and better the lives of ordinary Americans. It does seem, you know, at first glance and second glance, to be definitely a little right-wing coded.
Not just a little. I mean, it seems like you're trying to steal their rhetoric and just rebrand it something else. Abundance, because who could be against abundance? We all want more, Henry. I want more dessert after dinner. I want more of everything. It's what are the consequences of that? Because here's the thing, you do away with all of those reviews and all of the regulations, you know, how many people end up dead on the other side of this? How much abuse happens? How much wage theft happens if we get rid of all the regulators and all the cops on the beat? I don't know. I'm struggling with it. Struggling with the abundance agenda.
No, I definitely agree. And that's one of our main concerns is, you know, you can talk about speeding up the processes to build things, and I'm all in favor for that. You know, I grew up a Californian. I would love if our high-speed rail was already in place, getting to work. But you need to be careful with the way that you change things. Unilaterally getting rid of all environmental reviews might speed up some good projects, but it's also going to speed up a hell of a lot of bad ones.
Yep.
And, you know, oil spills, environmental pollution, those are real things that affect people's lives, and we need to be careful with it. And it's not just that, but I think we would disagree that these are the main impediments to abundance in the United States. We'd say that a lot of working class people might not benefit as much as abundance proponents would claim. You know, we're also in support of common sense tenant protections. And that's something that I think a lot of abundance fans tend to oppose. And as we saw yesterday at the abundance themed Welcome Fest, some abundance proponents like Josh Barrow are somewhat openly opposed to the idea of unions.
Yeah. No, and look, that's ultimately, you know, it's more for them, less for everyone else. And this is the kind of elitist ideology that most working people have taken it on the chin over for decades now. I mean, we were sold on this idea years ago of, you know, if we just give the rich people all the money, they know what to do with it, and it'll trickle down to the rest of us. If you just deregulate and give them the ability to build their things, it'll happen. Now we're talking about, hey, let's not regulate AI for the next decade. I know how that's going to work out, and it's not going to help working people. But again, it sounds like more of these ideas that you would expect coming from the corporate right, that the corporate left is saddling the Democratic Party with, which is why, again, I keep coming back to the reason the Democratic Party is so unpopular is because of these kind of ideologies and these kind of policies that aren't going to put food on the table, get kids to be able to go to college any easier, or any of that stuff. I don't buy it. I've seen this movie under a different title before, and it didn't work.
Yeah, and you brought up AI regulations. I think one of the main concerns is the people funding a lot of the abundance groups and a lot of the abundance project are Silicon Valley tech leaders. These are billionaires, be it Dustin Moskovitz, the co-founder of Facebook, Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, Peter Thiel, the extremely right-wing Silicon Valley billionaire, is involved with it, as is Mark Andreessen, who called himself an unpaid intern of Doge and is, you know, friends with Elon Musk. Patrick Collison is a billionaire, a very young one, who seems very influential in this space. And so I think we just need to keep our eyes open, you know? When billionaires are funding things, my suspicions are always that they're funding projects to benefit themselves.
Oh, gee.
And I think that's a reasonable suspicion.
My grandfather always used to say, and this is going back, you know, 30, 40 years ago, my grandfather always said, if a rich guy's going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you don't need something, you better spend two to get it, because they understand return on investment. So if they're spending all of this money to try and convince us of this abundance platform, we better one, hold our hand on our pocket to make sure we don't get it picked, and then figure out how we oppose most of what's coming out of their mouth.
Yeah, and you know, like I said, there's some good ideas in there interspersed with others. And you know, the abundance want us to take all of it or leave it. And I think the reasonable approach is take the good stuff and leave the bad. But that's the kind of discerning choices that they don't want us to be able to make.
Yeah. Last question I've got for you, because obviously you've been watching the bromance, you know, breakup going on between Elon and Trump, with Elon calling for Trump's impeachment. I got a bookie line wondering how long before Trump has Musk arrested. Any thoughts on the big breakup?
Yeah, I think the main thing I would say is whether or not Elon Musk is now anti-Trump, he's still a pernicious force somebody that should be kept out of Democratic politics. And figures at yesterday's event were talking about trying to welcome him back into the Democratic Party, bring him back into the fold. And, you know, he's responsible for thousands of deaths. He's responsible for the gutting of the federal workforce. And he is a dangerous figure. Yep. We cannot allow him to have influence over any party in the American political system.
Absolutely. My hope out of this, and I said this earlier, my hope out of this is both parties realize having one person with the kind of influence and resource that he has is not good for democracy. It's not good for policy. And maybe we start taxing rich people and, you know, doing what they did during the FDR years. Get rid of them.
Couldn't agree more.
Just a thought. But Henry, I appreciate your time. Keep up the great work. And thanks so much for bringing this to our attention.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
Henry Burke, senior researcher there at the Revolving Door Project. Make sure you check out their work, therevolvingdoorproject.org. Want to hear your thoughts. Did you catch Welcome Fest or NeoLib or DLC Fest? Did you catch it? I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly cloudy tonight, a couple of showers and storms and lows in the low 50s. For the weekend, a mix of sun and clouds, still some storms possible, highs in the mid-70s. Only in the 60s Monday, breezy, cooler, and more rain possible. Currently at 64 degrees.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Michael Negron of the Small Business Majority.
You know, Trump administration thinks that they're doing a solid for small business with their policies. And so having business owners out there talking about how, whether it's tariffs, whether it's potential cuts to healthcare, how it's going to hurt their bottom line, how it's going to hurt their consumers or their employees. I do think that will have a real impact. Every time he does something, he gets really bad feedback and he retreats in the face of it.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekday afternoons, 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it looks like President Taco's at it again, as Donald Trump appears from his Truth Social posts. He appears to be retreating from his earlier stance on China. He's now calling President Xi Jinping tough and hard to make a deal with. Despite, you know, recent accusations that China violated past agreements, Trump now seems quite eager for direct talks. Sources say he's fixated on speaking with Xi to kind of break the deadlock because he believes he's Mr. Art of the deal. He can, you know, just put me in there, coach. Personally, I think what we're seeing, major signs of desperation and weakness, potentially, I think, strengthening China's position. I don't know how you screw this up, but it looks like Mr. Art of the Deal is doing just that and here to share some thoughts. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's some fifth level of chess that I'm missing. But I've asked my good friend Scott Paul to come share some thoughts. Scott's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, great to be with you, Rick. And do you really think Donald Trump has played chess? You know, in two dimensions, much less five. All right, never mind.
But no, look, I happen to be listening to Fox News, and there was three dimensional chess, there was four dimensional chess, and then there was someone who went to five, DEFCON 5. I didn't even know there was a fifth dimension, but yeah, here we are. That's how far Donald Trump's ahead of the rest of us. So what's the scoop here? Is Mr. Art of the Deal going to get into the room and box something out, or? Does Ping keep dragging him along?
Yeah, well, you know, there's obviously a lot of, streams of, like, pressure back and forth. You know, one, Trump escalated in a hurry and then brought it back down. You know, Xi looking is like, okay, so he's sensitive to the stock market and to the bond market. Right. I mean, that's pretty much what happened. Yeah. Xi doesn't have to worry about political pressure because he's a dictator. So as long as he can, you know, he's got a surveillance state and he can keep things under wraps. He's going to be okay. So I think that they're like, you know what? What's the harm in kind of like waiting this out? But the other thing, and so there's that, and so that's just kind of like a, you know, didn't play chess. It was more like checkers. But Rick, the bigger problem is this: that Trump wants two things, and they are mutually exclusive from each other. Okay, on the one hand, he wants to be able to announce big deals where countries are going to buy lots of U.S. stuff, right? I mean, that's kind of what he's made
for. Or at least say that so he can have the moment, the headline for the day.
Which is what he said about China in early 2020 when a deal was made to stop ratcheting up the tariffs at the time. And China made agreements to purchase stuff, and they never did, right? They just never did. But and so I think Trump's like, well, maybe we can get them to purchase some stuff this time around. And there, for him, there's a lot of appeal to that. But on the other hand, the other thing that I think that he realizes, and certainly a lot of his advisors do, is that they want to de-risk from China. They want to pull supply chains out. They want to put a lot of pressure on U.S. companies to move out of China and to come to the United States or to go somewhere else or to pay a big consequence to that. And the thing about that approach, and I support a lot of what that's trying to do, because I don't think China's ever going to change its behavior. So right. I do think we need some de-risking and decoupling. The challenge with that is that, and I'm just going to be honest here, it does require some sacrifice, right? I mean, there will be some adjustment. There might be some supply chain. As supply chains get realigned or tariffs go to effect, there might be increased costs for businesses, and they may pass some, not all, but some of those along to consumers for a period of time. And so there'd be like a one-time bump in prices if you do this. Now, I personally think it's worth doing that, because I think it's worth having the capabilities back in the United States, and that in the long run, that's going to make us better off. But there are two-year election cycles. Right. And, you know, Democrats are wanting to, I think, pound on everything that Trump is doing in the economic arena. And so I don't know that he's going to get any help there. So it's I don't think he's solved this kind of conundrum yet. So even if Xi was willing to come to the table, I'm not sure that Trump knows what he wants.
No, and that's where I'm at. You know, had he hired you to give that speech you just gave, you would have gotten me to come along. And I think you would have gotten a lot of working people to come along, because it makes sense. We want to reshore manufacturing. We want to be able to have some control over our supply chain, not just for jobs and for the economy, but, you know, for when bad things happen, that we can ramp up production if we need to. But I think I'm more in the camp of what you just said. I don't think he knows really what he wants. If, hey, we can raise a bunch of revenue, or, hey, we're going to create a bunch. You can't do both.
Right. That's right.
There's no bowl. Right. But I guess the question that I have is, if we believe the second part, that we both agree should be a direction the country goes, what do you say to the Democrats who are now pushing this abundance theory of, we can have all this stuff, you know, trade and, you know, no tariffs and all this stuff, you know, because that seems to be the response of no, we can have Kate and Edith too.
Yeah, that's a bunch of that's an abundance of dollar store jobs or Amazon warehouse jobs. That's not my definition of abundance. And I think there's two things, and there's two important critiques of that. One is that, you know, we do need to rebuild our capacity to generate well-paying blue-collar jobs. And there are only a few examples of those types of jobs right now. And manufacturing has been and is one of those. I think the other factor, and I think this is also very important, with all this conversation about how AI and everything else is going to disrupt the job market. I have no doubt that in some ways it will. But in manufacturing, I mean, we've already seen the impacts of a lot of robotics, a lot of automation, a lot of productivity, a lot of machine learning. And it probably puts a ceiling on the number of manufacturing jobs that you can create. But that's a sector that's already been disrupted, right? I mean, it's the other things like coding or what have you that are really going to feel a whammy from that. So there's a real opportunity in manufacturing. And I don't want to say it's AI proof, but I do think it's a little more AI proof than a lot of other types of jobs, because you do need that physical manipulation, even if it's to build robots, right? You need that. And so I think there's some opportunity there. And the idea that we can depend on China for abundance to deliver us cheap goods. Look, if you're a Zoomer, I get it. It sounds great because you have debt, you're not making a lot of money, and those cheap goods are awesome. But in the process, you're foregoing excellent job opportunities to be there for you in the future, and then for the next generation as well. And that's what we're lacking right now.
Yeah, I was just reading about this this welcome conference that went on Wednesday in D.C. I don't know if you saw anything about this.
I didn't, Rick. No.
But there's this guy, Josh Burrow, a journalist, who said. When I look at policies in New York that stand in the way of abundance, very often if you look under the hood, you'll eventually find a labor union at the end that's the driver. And his argument is you know, it's those labor unions who want good wages and health care and retirement. It's those people who are demanding to have a standard of living in those jobs that are standing in the way of our abundance. We could have so much of all of this stuff if just those working people work for crap wages.
What a fantasy. I mean, seriously.
But that's what's being sold, Scott.
I think what that is in so many different ways is the DLC and neoliberalism masquerading with a new brand, right? I mean, that's what it sounds a lot like to me. And I will say this. I do think that there are things that we can knock down to make it easier to get things done.
Sure.
And whether it's permitting or what have you, I don't think that we should step over working people to do it. I don't think we need to spoil our environment to do it as well. But I do think that there are ways to get some things done faster. But the idea that you want to short circuit like working people and unions, which are the bedrock of like middle class jobs in the United States, is an enormous mistake. Right. It is an enormous mistake. And you're going to have an abundance of really poor paying jobs with poor benefits.
Yeah, I mean, he went after, you know, the subway drivers. You know, in New York, they've got two people on a train. I'm going, he's like, well, they don't do that anywhere in the world. I'm going, so we're going to kick working people out of jobs so you can save a fraction of the cost of doing things just so you could have just a touch more. I mean, this is my frustration with the discussion. And I think why Democrats, unfortunately, have lost a portion of the working class because of people like this and theories like this.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it's just like, okay, so it's the fact that there are two workers on a subway that's causing us to have a shortage of public investment and stuff. That's what it is.
That's the argument. We could have more houses. He went on this rant about how we could have more houses if you know, if the unions weren't in the way. But the reality is you know, unions don't control the housing market, the home building market almost at all. I don't think there's any percentage of the home building market that unions have any access to. I wish they did. But it's this fantasy world of, you know, this is what's in the way if we could just get rid of them. And I fear, and this is, you know, I've had conversations with a number of my labor friends. I fear this kind of rhetoric coming out of Democrats gives people like Sean O'Brien the cover to go court Republicans. And, you know, they're never going to deliver what workers need, but it's going to give them the cover.
Yeah. And it's interesting to me that this is coming at a time where there has been some crossover among political parties and populism. And you can, I look, there are many critiques of this, I realize, But you do have some Republicans who, at least with their mouths, are saying, I'm for working people now, or I'm against Medicaid cuts. Now, I don't know that they certainly don't control the Congress. And then they're also like, I'm for a tough trade policy. I'm for getting tough on China, and I'm for Buy America. And the unfortunate response from, you know, I guess, intellectual, you know, left of center folks is basically to say, well, we need a different brand, you know, and that's going to be abundance. Right. And so it's like, you know, we're going to cede the populism to them, which is a big mistake. And we're going to be the responsible people, and we're going to do the abundance. I don't know that there is a majority for that out there.
No, but fear is, and this is where my problem is, the money is behind that. The moneyed interests are behind it, because it's a way to stop working people for demanding better wages, health care, retirement security, all the things that labor unions push for and working people want. This is another way of Democrats not delivering on what needs to be done. And it's a frustration point for me. Look, I know the Republicans are never going to bring that around. That agenda is never going to come out of their voting record. But you got these handful of Democrats who, you know, it's like poisons the well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's I get why people are looking at critiques of what the Biden administration did to try to craft a theory of governing moving forward to respond to those very specific things. But I think they're fighting the last battle. Yeah. Right. I think they're fighting the last battle. I don't think that they're thinking about the future. And when you look at populist economic policies, they're still very popular. They are. So, you know, that's my takeaway.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. Let's finish up on this, because I got to get to this Ships for America Act. Because I think this fits into what the abundance crowd would want. You know, if we just had slave labor in this country, Scott, we could build ships. If we could just take prisoners out of prison and make them build ships, we could have an abundance of ships. We could compete with China.
And probably get rid of the Jones Act, too. Right. I have to believe that would be part of what they would argue. And here's the reality. We gave it away because we stopped investing in shipbuilding. We alone as a country got rid of shipbuilding subsidies when nobody else did. And then we stood by while China built up its shipbuilding industry with like three or four different layers of subsidies, subsidized steel, subsidized shipbuilding, and then state-owned firms who had to buy the ships, right? And so you had this beautiful, in Trump's words, this beautiful kind of like system of how they were able to lift up their shipbuilding. And now when you look forward, China has 70% of all the commercial shipping orders booked looking ahead, 70% in the entire world. So that's not good. And we're starting almost from scratch. We make 5, maybe 10 ships a year, whereas China makes like 1,200, 1,500 ships a year. And so even if we were to double that, you know, it doesn't sound like a lot, but we need to do that. And we need to have that capability because, quite honestly, and I hope this brings it into focus, what Ukraine was able to do to the Russian Air Force was in so many ways kind of Pearl Harbor-like. I mean, they were able to mount surprise, inflict damages. Russia's going to have a hard time rebuilding all of that stuff because of sanctions. Now, if we were to get hit in some way, our Navy, we have virtually no capacity to build up ships quickly in the United States. We are totally screwed, basically. That is the bottom line. We are screwed.
Yeah, but in a capitalist environment, China would be more than happy to send us ships. They would be, you know, in the middle of a war, you've got to keep business as business. The business of business is business. So I'm sure they'd be more than happy to sell us some ships.
I'm sure they would be, Rick. But the bottom line here is that this is something that has concerned kind of military folks for a while. And obviously, from a jobs perspective, shipyards jobs have been good working class jobs in these communities. And we used to have a lot of them in this country, and now we have very few. And so I like this because, You know, Senator Mark Kelly, he's a very smart guy. Senator Todd Young, Republican from Indiana, very smart guy. I mean, they're on board on this, and they're building up a lot of congressional support. We're working with them to try to do this, and this could be supplemented by a trade case that the Trump administration has already said that they're going to impose, like a docking fee on Chinese ships to help to pay for all of this. And so I hope this comes together, but we need Congress to know that this is important.
And yeah, absolutely. And a plan. You know, and I just saw the Financial Times had a big piece on China's Made in China 2025 plan, of which this was part, right? I mean, this is all part of their grand scheme to take over manufacturing globally. They've written it down. We know what it is. We just haven't bothered to compete. It's sad stuff.
Yeah, they've had a plan. They've executed it. They've executed a lot of things very well. And unfortunately, it's put us in a bind, right? It's put us in a bind, in part because we didn't have our own plan, and we let them do that, and we shouldn't have. So, again, we're basically starting from scratch here, but we need to rebuild this capacity. We need to do it as quickly as possible, because one thing we don't have an abundance of, Rick, is ships in the United States.
And that comes back to steel. That comes back to skilled craftspeople who know how to do this stuff. We've had not just material drains, but we've had a brain drain. There's a lot of catching up to do, and we're still basically marching in place, or actually falling behind with this administration. But Scott, as always, I appreciate the time and the information. Good stuff.
Of course, Rick. So happy to be with you.
Thanks so much. Our good friend Scott Paul. Want to hear your thoughts. About time? Are you on the abundance side of the thing? Is that appealing? Hey, we can have everything. We can have cake and we can eat it and we don't have to make it or clean up afterwards. It will be fabulous. Want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1894. That was the day that the Colorado State Militia troops came to Cripple Creek to intervene in a mining strike. But unlike every other time in U.S. mining history that a state militia was called out, the Colorado State troops did not have their guns pointed at the miners. Instead, Colorado's populist governor David Waite had ordered the troops to the area because he was concerned by the large private army of gun thugs the mining company was amassing. Cripple Creek was in gold mining country at the base of Pikes Peak. In February, the mine operators had declared that the miners would have to work a 10-hour workday for 8 hours of wages. The miners could stay on the 8-hour schedule, but they would have to take a 17% pay cut. Outraged, the miners walked out of the mine. The Western Federation of Miners led the strike, which wore on for 5 long months, with violence on both sides. The mine owners were determined to end the walkout and gathered a private gun force of more than 1,200 hired thugs. On June 5th, there was a standoff between the miners and the company hired guns at the Bull Hill Mine. Unable to take the mine, the company guns instead unleashed their anger and fury on the townspeople of Cripple Creek. They raided homes, arrested people, and beat them in the streets. In response, the governor threatened to keep the state militia in the area until the strike was settled. The mine owners knew that they were beat, opting to settle the strike, marking a major victory for the Western Federation of Miners and their members.
It is for our little children that seem to us so dear, but for us nor them dear workers the bosses do not care.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So patronage hires front and center. Evidently, Big Balls officially now patronage hire a full-time government employee with the General Services Administration. Edward Kornstein, Luke Ferrader, and Ethan Shatran. Evidently, all of their employment has been upgraded to full-time from their special restricted government employee classification. Now they are full-time patronage hires. And hey, who's surprised? Anybody? Anybody surprised? Like I said earlier, I wonder if Big Balls has got all the data. All of it. Blackmail material around. Now I'm looking over at Russ Voigt at OMB, the Office of Management and Budget. Evidently, he doesn't want to traumatize federal workers anymore. What's with that? It's rich, considering he spent the better part of his career gleefully sharpening the axe to go after those workers. And after leading sweeping cuts across agencies all across our government, layoffs, budget slashes, morale nukes, he's now suddenly, miraculously singing kumbaya about the value of incredible work that's being done by career staff? Really? But wait, this is the part that's fun. While he was gutting the rest of our government, he wants his own OMB. He wants his own staff to grow by 4%. Because, of course, his workload is just too much. Apparently slashing everyone else, perfectly fine. But when it hits home, suddenly we need resourceful civil servants, he says. And those past quotes about making workers feel like villains, totally out of context. Naturally. Also, get ready for DOGE. Yeah, the acronym is now gonna stay. To become permanent in the Trump era. Elon gone, clearly, as we've talked about, but still very much going to be Voigt's Frankenstein. And Democrats aren't buying the latest charm offensive. And frankly, who could blame them? But welcome to the GOP hypocrisy tour. Also, a 22-year-old who was just bagging groceries about a year ago, now going to be running the Department of Homeland Security's program meant to prevent terrorism and hate-fueled violence. Thomas Vougat, who was doing landscaping during the pandemic and quoting Billy Joel lyrics on Instagram, is now in charge of the National Extremism Prevention Program. And my thought is, sure, why not? A 22-year-old with his wide depth of qualifications. Does he have any poli-sci degree, some campaign cheerleading, an internship somewhere at the Heritage Foundation? Aha, that's it. No security background, no counterterrorism, no experience, just vibes, selfies, and love for Trump since 13. And the Department of Homeland Security is, well, out here praising his work ethic? Meanwhile, you've got actual experts getting purged, even as he posed in front of the Department of Homeland Security seal like a Bond villain in training. It's like Project 2025 decided the best way to fight domestic terrorism is to hire the guy who once begged Texas lawmakers to fund global aid and then rebrand into a MAGA influencer. We've got an intern at the wheel. Buckle up. Going to be an interesting ride. Without question. But here again, this is patronage land. This is what happens when you get people who filled out the right essay, kissed the right ring, or, well, the right, you know. This is what we're getting stored. This isn't going to be the last story you're going to hear. This administration is full of unqualified ideologues who are hell-bent on destroying government. So you put people in charge of things that they can't not screw up. And then go, gee, see, look, government doesn't work. We should privatize and profitize. Yeah, this is where we are. And understand, my red-hatted friends, this is what you voted for. Because this idea of we didn't know, nonsense. Talked about it all during the campaign. Laid this exact scenario out during the campaign, where it was going to be about kissing the ring or the giant orange melon behind. Not about qualifications, not about doing the job, not about good government, certainly not about efficiency. It's about patronage. It's about power. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO 1230 AM, W255 DN Wausau, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. The Trump administration has done what it said it couldn't, brought Kilmar Abrego-Garcia to the U.S. after mistakenly deporting him to El Salvador. A federal grand jury has indicted him in Tennessee for smuggling migrants. CBS's Nicole Scangio reports.
Prosecutors say Abrego-Garcia falsely claimed to police he was in St. Louis on a construction project. But investigators charge he'd traveled through Houston with nine Hispanic men and had $1,400 in his pocket.
He will be prosecuted in our country, sentenced in our country if convicted, and then returned after completion of his sentence.
A former police chief and convicted killer has been captured after he escaped from a prison, triggering a massive manhunt in the mountains of northern Arkansas. CBS's Peter King.
Grant Hardin's crimes made him the subject of a TV documentary called Devil in the Ozarks. He was serving a 50-year sentence for rape and 30 years for murder.